delighted to be here and to give this talk. Let me try this thing. This is work that actually just came out last month with Eric Pompitz and Neil Weiner. Okay, so the principal thing that people like me, phenomenologists, are trying to understand is, it works, what are we going to find at the LHC? Yeah, so you go to the LHC, here's the status as of last night, okay? As is typical with these sort of things, blue means good, red means not necessarily bad, but but not running, yeah. Okay, it does mean what you think it means. It actually has to do with the temperature that the wonderful beamline is at, and you can see there are certain sectors of this collider that are actually already down to the temperature that they need to be, okay, the temperature of the magnets. So you can see this is already some, you know, this is promising, you know, you've got magnets and they're cooling down, so it's actually getting close, only a few months away. This is very good. We also have the idea, so from this is from the experiment side, but then on the theory side, I think it's fair to say that weak scale supersymmetry, one of the words in the title, is of course one of the widely believed as a distinct possibility for physics beyond the Standard Model. In fact, last summer I had the privilege to even go looking. I've actually made it down into the Atlas pit. They let me down, surprisingly. And by the way, this is the photo of me visiting Atlas, but actually I also visited CMS on a more personalized tour. And I have to say that if anything, I thought CMS was even more impressive than Atlas. Probably only because the Atlas has already been constructed and it's sort of gray metal, and if you look at the CMS, it's multicolored, so I'm sort of impressed.
That, by the way, is the correct statement of San Bernardino.
Very good. So what I really want to talk about today is flavor and supersymmetry. And let me begin, I think, by simply just reviewing things that many of you already know, but just to sort of establish notation and to move from there, namely flavor in the Standard Model. Okay. So in the Standard Model, we know that flavor comes from Yukawa couplings, comes from the interactions of the Higgs with the quarks. And the way this is done is you just write down the most general thing you can, namely the quarks coupling to the Higgs. Is there a point? Oh, this is a pointer, yeah?
Also, there's a physical thing here.
Oh, great. Oh, yeah. Old school. I'll get this. So the fermions coupling to the Higgs with these wonderful parameters, the Yukawa couplings. As written, these are arbitrary 3x3 complex matrices in flavor space, and there's, you know, three of them, or maybe even four, depending on how you put neutrinos in. You put the Higgs in, and you take the quarks, and they have a form like this. And you notice that I've written this as U123, not the usual quarks you're used to thinking about, up, down, strange, because after all, that's not what we have yet once we are staring at it in this form. So you do the standard thing, and you use the freedom to diagonalize these matrices, rotating the quarks, okay, and you perform these wonderful rotations, U and D. So some rotation on the left-handed quarks, some rotation on the right-handed quarks, and you are left with a set of Yukawa couplings that are diagonal in the flavor basis. Now I've written it as DSB. And all of this flavor rotation has disappeared everywhere in your theory except for where it remains in the coupling to the weak interactions, namely in the CKM matrix. Okay. So all these complex, there's fermions, this is what you have, and then you go through and you get to a point where it's just in CKM, okay, and in the weak interactions. In supersymmetry, the situation is different because we have not exact supersymmetry, but broken supersymmetry. So we have masses for the superpartners, soft masses for the scalars, various couplings that you can write involving, again, also the scalar components of these chiral superfields as well as the Higgs. Okay. And all of these parameters have their own flavor basis. They are some arbitrary matrices. Well, these are not entirely arbitrary, okay, they're Hermitian, and they have, okay, so there's restrictions on that, but their off-diagonal elements are arbitrary and can be whatever you like. Now, so there's a whole number of them. So I've only listed the masses of the up-type quarks, the quark doublets and the quark singlets, and of course there's the same thing for leptons, etc. After you rotate the superfields to remove the Yukawa 3x3 matrix structure, okay, to go back into a basis where the quarks now have this diagonal, just ordinary masses, okay, diagonal basis. After you do this rotation, you're still left with these parameters being essentially arbitrary in flavor space. Okay, so the diagonalization that left you with just quark masses and then just CKM elements doesn't just suddenly diagonalize these things in general. This is the supersymmetric flavor problem. Okay. Now, why is it a problem? Well, it's not necessarily a problem, it's just that's what happens. But here's what happens if this were true in a weak scale supersymmetric model. If you look at a probe of flavor violations such as K0K0 bar mixing, which has been very well measured over time, in the standard model, this proceeds through interactions involving the CKM elements here and the weak interaction. That's what this famous vertex here, there, and there is. Okay, you do the usual thing, you sum this up, and this matches the standard model quite well. You generalize to supersymmetry, and now there are new classes of diagrams. Not only the analog of the diagrams of replacing the W with, say, its superpartner, the Wino, but there are also diagrams where you can replace the W with, say, a gluino. And the gluino will now couple to the quarks and squarks, like this. And your off-diagonal mixings come in here, as I've represented as a mass insertion. So this is the new contribution you can get in supersymmetry if you have these flavor arbitrary matrices, as I mentioned before. You do the computation of the size of this contribution, and here's the estimate. Okay, so first of all, you've gone from what was previously a weak interaction to now something that is proportional to alpha s, the strong interaction, right, to the fourth power, because we've got four powers of g, right, alpha s squared. And there are two insertions, so these are mass squared insertions that go in, so it's m12 squared divided by roughly the average squark mass squared. Okay, this quantity squared, and then 1 over the gluino mass. This is for when the squarks and gluinos are comparable. Okay, this is the limit that I've taken. If you then put in the numbers for this to say, well, how big can this be such that it does not contribute significantly to delta m sub k, you find that the bound is that this quantity here, okay, m12 squared, here, I'll write it here, m12 squared over m the off-diagonal element squared divided by the diagonal element squared has to be smaller than, well, in some range here. Something between about 0.06 to 10 to the minus 3, depending on the form of the mixing that is in place. In other words, whether the mixing is in the left-left or the right-right basis or left-right. This is taking, some average, some weak scale-ish quark and gluino masses. This problem isn't isolated to just the first, second generation, which sometimes one hears. If you just go and look at, B0, B0 bar mixing, there again, you're now sensitive to a different element, the M13 squared, but you still have this alpha S enhancement, okay, going through the diagram. And again, you turn the crank, you go through to figure out how big this can be, and these elements also have to be fairly small. Okay, so all these pieces of experimental data are pointing to the squark mass matrices are seemingly have to be experimentally very diagonal. Like that's what all of this data seems to be pointing to. These are just two of an ensemble of potential problems when you have general weak scale supersymmetry. There is not just problems with the Skork sector, there's problems with the Slepton sector, and there are problems not only with delta F equal to 2 processes, like I showed with K0 bar mixing, but delta F equal to 1, okay, just flavor change by 1 unit. There are problems with the CP phases in this system, okay, and a number of things. So I've just sort of listed them here, and I'll come back to a few pieces of this near the end. Okay, so I'll come back to some of this. There are other actually related problems, as it turns out, problems associated with if you have phases in your supersymmetric model, in your low-energy model, although it doesn't change flavor, there it can give rise to contributions to electric dipole moments of, say, the electron or the neutron or mercury, okay, depending on, again, the scales that you have. There's another issue with proton decay, which I won't say much about, but it impacts this. Okay. So the statement is that I am trying to get out of this is that if you just naively supersymmetrize the standard model, namely you have the MSSM with its particle content and a flavor arbitrary mass matrices, okay, flavor arbitrary, it's completely ruled out by these FCNC constraints.
What do you mean by flavor arbitrary?
Arbitrary in the sizes of the off-diagonal elements of the mass squared. Okay. Completely ruled out at the weak scale. Just
if there are off-diagonal elements
without any special structure, then you would have already have found this in K0 bar mixing, in mu to E gamma, in many of these processes. That's the statement. Okay. So the theorist seeing... Hang on. So the theorist seeing this says, okay, so there has to be a mechanism that ensures that the supersymmetric contributions to this flavor change are small. Okay. And that's been one of the large amounts of effort in at least the model building community and the effective field theory community is trying to search for mechanisms that do this. Okay. Many, many years of model building, more than 15 in fact, have gone through a number of iterations to try to get to proposals that would solve this problem, going from the idea of gauge mediation, where the contributions to the superpartners are proportional to gauge interactions. If they're proportional to gauge interactions, they come diagonal. They don't know about flavor, for example. Anomaly mediation works in more or less a similar way, but it is another proposal so that the contributions to superpartners are dominantly in the flavor diagonal thing. Same with gauge-Unno mediation, something that I had worked on some years ago as well. All of these proposals, while interesting and presumably will be tested or ruled out at the LHC, have nevertheless their own issues when you sort of dig them and you dig them apart. Okay, one of the obvious things is the role of what I call the mu term, which is just the masses, if you like, the mass of the Higgsinos, okay, and mu H up H down, which has to be there in the model because we don't see massless Higgsinos around, so we've got to give a mass term for this. Generating this term is subtle in all of these cases. It's not subtle if you just do sort of a minimal supergravity-ish type of thing. Okay, that straightforward to see where that comes from. Some of these proposals also have to do with sequestering, that is somehow separating the supersymmetry breaking sector from the MSSM in some way. And again, depending on how that's done, that takes effort. And there is the potential for, you know, danger. I mean, you try to sequester, but then you have some light field and suddenly your sequestering is gone again. So it takes some effort to make these proposals go. In any case, all of them from a phenomenological point of view have said that we want to take the Skork mass matrix in its ugliest form here, okay, the 6x6 form. Here are the Skorks that came from the left-handed quarks, the partners to the left-handed quarks, the partners to the right-handed quarks here. Here is their mass matrices themselves, and then the off-diagonal elements that mix the left and right components. And by this I mean the particles that came from the left-handed and the sparticles that came from the right-handed components of the fields. The lore is that Suzy breaking must be flavor blind. This leads to the second point of the talk, R symmetry. Supersymmetry already has an R symmetry. probably most or all of you already know this, right? The notion that basically you can rotate, if I think about it from a superspace perspective, it has to do with rotating the phase of the superspace coordinate, the Grassmann coordinate here. As acting on fields, what this corresponds to is that a given chiral superfield can have some charge R, and when you carry this through into the component formalism, well, since now theta transforms under this, you see that the fields, the scalar, the fermion, and the F component, the auxiliary component, all transform with different units of R charge, right? Decreasing units, as I've shown here. It sort of smells like R parity, which is sort of the origin of that name, even though it's really not that. In the MSSM, just for concreteness, and I'm only writing a couple of things here, but I just want to say that because you have a d squared theta in front, okay, then the superpotential automatically has to carry 2 units of R charge. Similarly, because field strengths, namely the analog of the kinetic terms for gauge bosons, have to come in, so they also have to have an R charge of 1. So these are determined, and then these are assignments that are the typical thing done in the MSSM. Okay? And so what you can see is, when I construct a Yukawa coupling, I have an up-type quark, a down-type quark, and a Higgs, and so that gives me an R charge 2 object, so it works for the superpotential. But in particular, once I want to write down a new term, H up, H down, this is 0, so this violates the R symmetry. So it shows that there is violation of the R symmetry implicit in the MSSM. R symmetry and Suzy breaking have sort of a long history to them, and it goes back a long way. If you write the simplest way to break supersymmetry globally, okay, the O'Rafferty model, this is a case where you just have a field, you have a linear term in the superpotential, and with suitable interactions, choosing the parameters appropriately, you can end up getting an F term for X, solving for the equations of motion, getting this wonderful quantity. And since X must have R charge 2 to be consistent with the superpotential being R charge 2, and you decrease by 2 units to get to the auxiliary component, you see that the auxiliary component then doesn't carry any R charge, so the O'Rafferty model doesn't break R symmetry. Okay. Recently, interligator Seiberg and Shi, and many others now, have realized that actually a wide class of supersymmetric theories seem to break supersymmetry, but in a metastable vacuum. The details of this are things that even I'm still trying to understand and how it applies. But one thing is clear is that in many of these cases, the low energy descriptions of the model in terms of once you integrate out the high energy degrees of freedom and write down what's the superpotential of the low energy degrees of freedom, they look like O'Rafferty models. And as a consequence, the metastable local Suzy breaking minimum actually, in many cases, has an accidental R symmetry at the origin of field space. These folks, Stein, Feng, and Silverstein, showed that explicit examples where the R symmetry breaks, and it actually breaks to a discrete subgroup, a discrete subgroup that's maybe larger than even Z2, like a Z4, Z2n. Okay? So these are cases where it's not crazy to imagine the R symmetry may actually be present. There is a problem, though. Okay, there's a problem of having R symmetry around. And that can be manifest, at least phenomenologically, in the simplest situation of trying to understand how you get Gaugino mass, right? This is the standard thing. So an unbroken R symmetry has usually been considered a problem. And in fact, if you read their papers, they say, it's got an R symmetry. Oh, it's a problem. Okay, but now we're going to go and try to, fix it up in some way. The issue is very simple. Okay, the issue is here's the superpotential for the field strengths. This has to have R charge 2. You couple it to some hidden sector field that gets an F term. Okay. But if this thing gets an F term, to make this whole thing consistent, X had better have no R charge. So its F component is going to have R charge. It's going to violate the R symmetry. Okay. So Majorana masses for the Gauginos violate the R symmetry. It doesn't have to be so. There is an alternative, though it was one that, to my knowledge, although it, I'm sure it goes back earlier, but it was best espoused in a paper by Fox, Nelson, and Weiner in 2002, in which they showed that you could write down interactions of the superpotential with another field, a field in the adjoint representation of the gauge group, so that the fermions would pair up and get a Dirac mass that doesn't violate your symmetry. This requires that you have some D term, some say auxiliary U1 prime that gets a D expectation value, and as long as this thing has to have R charge 1, so it's D component and it's vanishing R charge. So it doesn't. So this breaking of supersymmetry doesn't lead to a violation of R symmetry. Okay, this is what these guys realize. It requires, as I say, this D term to be around. Now, what we realized was, and that was the whole point of our paper, is that actually, when you take many of these pieces together and you look at the supersymmetric flavor problem, almost all of the numerical deficit of the problem, all the numerical problem, is coming from R violating interactions. And to our knowledge, I'm not aware of people who would realize this fact before. So what violates R symmetry in the MSSM? Well, I already pointed out that it is Gugino masses can do it. And what's the result of that? It means that then if you have a fermion that comes in and interacts with a Gugino, you can do a chirality flip on the Gugino line, if you like, flipping this around, and you're not paying a price of, say, a small quark mass or a small lepton mass, right? It's just a Gugino. I can take this whole thing and, to say, integrate out the gluino, and it gives me a dimension 5 operator between the fermions and the scalars, okay? You can then take the dimension 5 operator and couple it up, and off you go. And this is only suppressed by 1 over m gluino, or say 1 over m mu, and that's the piece that turns out to actually have a bulk of the problem when it comes to, say, looking at KNK on power mixing, UD gamma, as I'll show you. Okay, what else? Well, in addition to these sources of R symmetry violation, there's also R symmetry violation from A terms and from the mu term. Mu term I mentioned before, and A terms are also there. So, for example, what happens is that these entire blocks of the Skork mass matrix, the 6x6 mixing of all of these components, these entire blocks represent R symmetry violation, okay, in the model. This suggests a strategy. What if you could construct a low energy model that obeyed an R symmetry, and then what would be its consequences? Okay, and that's what I want to talk about for the rest. Okay, so R symmetric SUSY. So our idea is replace the MSSM with an R symmetric model, weak scale model. The R symmetry could be continuous. I'm sort of in the back of my mind, that's what I'm thinking, but it could be a discrete subgroup, a subgroup larger than just Z2, like a Z4. Okay? It could even be just simply an accidental symmetry that is very well preserved. It doesn't necessarily have to be exactly preserved, okay, for these things to follow, what I'm about to say. To get this to go, you need to do certain things. So obviously, one thing is you have to give Gugino's a mass. So we do this by this mechanism of giving them a Dirac mass. And you have to somehow do something with the mu terms, and there is also something very simple you can do. So I'm going to do these things and then show you what the results are for flavor. And you'll see how different it really is. Okay, so Dirac Gugino masses require for each gauge field, I need to have a superfield in the adjoint, so a gluino, color octet, if you like, a weak triplet, and some singlet, and these fields will then pair up through these operators to give me D terms, to give me mass terms that are Dirac and mass terms that obey the R symmetry. We don't violate it. You can do the same thing with mu terms with the masses of Higginos. What you do is you can add again a series of fields, we just call them RURD, and then you pair them up with ordinary mu terms, where now the R charges of R, these additional fields, differs from that of the R charge of H, by 2 units, and then you can see, well, that's easy. All right, we're done. So that eliminates these pieces. Finally, the scalar masses, because there is no left-right mixing, there is no A terms, there are no mu term, means there is no left-right mixing in this whole mass matrix. So the scalar mass matrix breaks up into components that are left-handed and right-handed, and they don't mix with one another. This is what happens when you do this. Okay, all right, so now, what does it mean? Okay. First, so the consequences are that, well, if I look at diagrams that involve left-right mixing, and there are a whole number of them, there's a whole class of this type of diagram, one type is what I have drawn here, where you have, mu right going in, some gaugino going around. This goes into a mu right. This mixes into a slepton left, okay, through a left-right mixing. There's a photon emitted somewhere, and off you go. This is our classic mu to e gamma type of process, violating lepton flavor. And this type of diagram and all of its cousins are gone. Right, they're just killed completely from the process. I'll show you how big that is in just a moment. Analogously, if it's even the same flavor diagram, this same type of thing contributes to electric dipole moments, and you can show that they are also gone in this approach. There are no contributions to electric dipole moments from the gaugino's squarks from this sector at all. Okay, they're just gone. In addition to just killing off left-right, you also have the ability to raise the gaugino mass. This is significant because numerically you'll see that to be able to satisfy the flavor violation, the bounds on flavor violation, raising the gaugino mass is actually important in this case. Ordinarily, you can't do it, right? You can't raise the gaugino mass because, well, they're related to one another. In particular, one of the ways in which you couple Majorana gauginos to Majorana masses to squarks is through the RGE, and this RGE is what gives rise to things like gaugino mediation. It's log enhanced. Okay, it is not finite. In this case, the contribution from a D term. Okay, this contribution turns out to actually be one loop finite. That is, it's not log enhanced. So it's the amount of scalar mass that you are generating as a result of having this gaugino around. You put the gaugino in a loop and you do the calculation, you find it's finite. And you can show why it's finite when you actually expand out these operators, writing down the effective operator that generates a scalar mass in the first place. There's no counter term. In addition to killing off left-right, you can also raise the gaugino mass somewhat, but not much more than a loop factor, because once you get more than a loop factor, you'll pull up the squark masses at the same point, the same time. So you can actually separate them by a loop factor, something you could not have done in just the MSSM. Okay, with these ingredients, yeah, now let me tell you about what the consequences are. Okay, and I'll try to step through them sort of, you know, as we go. Okay, if I can, there we go, oops. So here's the bound that I had presented to you before on Kanoff-Kanoff bar mixing. Okay. So Kanoff-Kanoff bar mixing had a bound on its off-diagonal element squared divided by its diagonal element squared to be smaller than this range, up to 10 to the minus 3 for these masses of squarks and gluinos. You could say, well, okay, fine. So suppose the squarks were just heavier, right? If I keep on raising the mass of all of the particles and the loop just gets small enough, how heavy do I have to raise them so that I can have arbitrary size, arbitrary off-diagonal elements? Well, here's how large. Since if you take the limit in which you go to heavy squarks, then the contribution to delta mk squared goes like the off-diagonal element, this piece, this delta, squared divided by m squark squared. And the significance of this is that, well, okay, so if I wanted to end up with delta of order 1, I would need to raise the squark mass to beyond 8 TeV for left-left mixing, or to beyond 500 TeV for left-left and right-right, that is the diagram with left-left and right-right in it, or just left-right mixing in the whole diagram itself. Okay? This is the statement. So this is what I mean when I say weak scale supersymmetry with arbitrary flavor elements in the mass matrices is completely ruled out at the weak scale. You put in the R symmetry, there is no left-right mixing bounds at all. Now that we've done that, we've killed these effective dimension 5 operators, so that now the suppression by raising the mass of the Galeno is even a little bit more. You go ahead and compute what the bound is. You compute how big can the Galenos and Squarks be with flavor arbitrary masses, and here's what you find. So if it's just left-left mixing, meaning just mixing in the left-handed components, the quark doublets, then these are curves of the Squark mass from 200 GeV to 1 TeV, and the Galeno mass from about 1 TeV on up to 10 TeV. So the statement is that you could have a Galeno, say, of about 4 TeV, and a Squark of about 500 GeV, and you could permit arbitrary off-diagonal elements in the Squark masses, okay? Doesn't have to be flavor blind. Okay, doesn't have to be flavor blind. Similarly, if I took left-left equal to right-right, this one is, you can see, more constrained. So now, for the same mass of Squark, holding this to be equal to 1, I'd have to go up to more like 8 TeV. But you can see that now, okay, well, maybe I can't go to 1, I could go to 0.3 or something, which for theories, 0.1 and 0.3 are all over 1, okay? So you can see that this is in a range where now, you know, you can realistically imagine arbitrary size flavor mixings in the Squark masses. Okay, that's the key. What else do you get from this? Okay, so you can go beyond just, you know, this is the delta F equal to 2 process. You can go to, say, epsilon prime over epsilon. This is really severely constrained in the MSSM. The constraint is actually that it has to be less than about 2^-5 if you have left-right mixing. Okay. So you can take this number, turn it around again, figure out the scale of the Squarks you would have to have for flavor arbitrary, and it's going to be in the, you know, PeV range. Okay, this is really heavy. This is again gone. This is completely killed once you impose an R symmetry. Okay, so there's essentially no bound in this case. Mu to E gamma, another process which people think would be something that you might see in, say, supersymmetry. This is also severely constrained. Now, this is the delta associated with the lepton mass matrix. So the 1-2 element, the off-diagonal element in the lepton mass matrix. Again, depending on whether it's left-left or right-right, it's severely constrained in the MSSM. You do an R-symmetric model, you find, first of all, the left-right is completely gone, and the left-left mixing, well, here's the size for this set of parameters. You can see that, say, for hundreds of GeV sleptons and, you know, between 500 GeV to a TeV or so, Dirac, Weno, and Beno, you're completely safe. Okay. So you could have, it really can be arbitrarily large. There are other effects. There are effects due to large tan beta. These are things that happen as a result of effectively the up-type Higgs can couple to down-type quarks through interactions that you obtain from, again, going through the process of mixing with a Higgs Eno, okay, integrating out the Galeno, and going from there. And you end up with effective mixings along this line. If you go through the process of large tan beta, you find that there are some effects. There are effects such as B goes to mu plus mu minus. This is very highly enhanced by some numbers of tan beta I'm supposed to remember. I think it's to the 5th or 6th power. Okay, it's a large number of powers. This type of process is also gone because there is no way, because this requires also an R symmetry to be able to mix the up-type Higgs to the down-type quarks. Okay, so this is killed at the same time. All right. That gives you an idea of the flavor, the contributions that you can kill with an R symmetry. Let me just now give you a little bit of a sketch of the of some of the phenomenology of this.
Before you go on, so with these kinds of terms, you get these nice properties, but they do look a little sort of baroque, or the models do. Are these things that naturally come out in this form of, say, ISS or some grander scheme where it's more sort of organized?
Right, so you're asking, what is my hidden sector, right, that leads to these terms? So you can have, so the idea that there's a hidden sector that leads to R symmetry preserving Susie breaking VEVs is there. But you still need to generate a D term at the same time. And for what I've been showing here, the D term is of order, if not even a little bit larger than the F term. That has to be arranged. Yeah, I'm not telling you how that comes about. All I'm saying is I'm imagining that I have these spurions that obey R symmetry and I proceed. But yeah, to my knowledge, there is no model that explicitly gives you a D term of this size. But the night is young. Okay, there may be ways to do this. This is virgin territory, I think. Okay. Other questions on this? Okay. So let me give you just a few bits of the phenomenology that come out of this proposal, and I'll tell you in addition to this other issues that come up in the scheme. Okay. So very roughly, and this is why it's in this plot with almost no numbers. This is what you anticipate from a model like this. You anticipate Gaugenos that tend to be, you know, moderately heavy, at least certainly the Gluino and also the Wino. The Beano is probably also heavy if these took ratios that you would sort of ordinarily have guessed from sort of a gut unified type of approach. Well, then, you know, this is sort of the ratio you would guess, but I don't know how small the Beano mass could be. As you drop the Beano mass small, its contributions to flavor-changing effects becomes larger, and it's not clear how, you know, exactly how small we can take this. We looked at only the contributions from this. You can show that once you raise the Beano up to, say, you know, this range, it's not going to contribute at all, but in this range, it's an issue you have to think about. The Higgsinos could be in some range in here, and that's completely fine. The same thing with Squarks and Sleptons, as I was sort of showing before. There are then also the color octet and the weak triplets, the adjoints, that could also have various masses, and they could be as light as all of the other particles, or they could be possibly heavier. There's a reason that they might be heavier. It has to do with generating the Higgs mass, okay, generating the quartic coupling in the MSSM. Okay, this is open as to how big this could be. So the obvious features are that, as I've shown with these delta parameters being equal to 1 or 0.3 or even 0.1, basically the Squark and Slepton mass matrices are completely arbitrary in size and phase. Now, that is true, and that statement is completely true, except for there's always some exception, except for one phase. It turns out that when you go through the calculation of epsilon k, and this is the only flavor violating observable that seems to actually constrain parameters in this scenario, you go through the situation with a phase in the 1-2 elements, left, right, and has to be, you have to take this product. The imaginary part of this product has got to be less than about 0.01. So this means that the phase, the imaginary part of these mass insertions, the off-diagonal elements, has got to be, you know, 0.1-ish or so. Otherwise, you would have violated epsilon k, the bound from epsilon k. But this is really the only constraint beyond the plots that I was showing before. These guys are heavy, I mentioned this, and that there is new particles, this color octet, the weak triplets. In fact, as I understand it, there's already some phenomenology colleagues that I know who are looking at the phenomenology of how well you can find these things. You know, octets and color triplets have been thought of before, and so now this is something, you know, this takes more motivation to look at. What else are you going to see? Well, what's the consequence of having these mass matrices being completely arbitrary. Right? What does it mean? It means that you go to the LHC, you do a S-channel exchange, a Gluino, you go into some squarks, but now the squarks have arbitrary flavor. Okay, so they're not just T-like or B-like or whatever. The squarks can then, for example, you could have one squark which would then decay into a top quark. Another squark could just go into some other quark that's not the top. Okay, this leads to a source of single top, which is actually quite large. Right, this is significant, and this is probably, if I understand this right, significantly larger than single top production that you would ordinarily find even in the standard model. I mean, why? Because, well, the single top production in the standard model, you usually have to do something like pop a B quark out of the parton distribution functions of the proton and then fuse it together, with a W to be able to produce a single top. So this is why TT bar was found at the Thevatron first and not single top. Right? It is due to this difference. So this is an example of the kind of thing you could see. Now, can you see this above background? What else are you going to see? How? I don't know. Okay? I'm just saying that this is an example of something there, and this is something that there's already a couple of postdocs that are looking at this with me, and so as soon as I know something, we'll tell you. This is what would happen from on the squark side. On the slepton side, you could produce sleptons. Okay, they again have arbitrary. They have arbitrary flavor, so that when they decay, they could go to, say, E mu. Okay, so you have a source of electron of different flavor leptons coming out of an ordinary production process. Yeah. With now large missing energy. Now, obviously, something like this, you look at this and you say, well, there's obviously a background from taus, because taus can go to electron, muon, missing energy. So you have to distinguish something like this from taus. This is now a detailed process to figure out how well you can do here. Some people have studied this kind of process before, and my memory is now that that you can probe to lepton masses in the sort of 250 GeV range or so, maybe 300. Another way that this has been probed is through the second to lightest neutralino to the lightest neutralino and then two leptons. But this is probably, this particular mode is probably going to be harder in our scenario, because the mass of this guy is order TeV or so, okay, or heavier.
Has somebody written a package where you feed them a Lagrangian like this and everything comes out? I mean, that seems like by now.
One would love to have that. The closest thing to that is a tool called, at least at tree level, the closest thing is called MadGraph, and it's a program that you input not the Lagrangian, but you input the interactions, and then you put in masses, parameters for that. And what it can do is to calculate tree level processes with large numbers of legs on the external side. In fact, as I understand it, one of the authors of MadGraph, some of the authors of MadGraph are looking at exactly that, to be able to say, to go beyond just putting in interactions, but saying you put in a Lagrangian with some particles with some quantum numbers, and then off you go. Yeah. So they are actually looking at that. Okay. Other question? Okay. So. Open questions to this. There is a whole number of different things which I haven't discussed, and because some of them we know, some of them we don't know, and that's just the way it is. That's how soon we are with this stuff. One of them is, you have an R symmetry. If the R symmetry is exact, it is enough to keep the lightest supersymmetric particle stable. There's no need for R parity. Okay? It serves the role as R parity. Okay? If R symmetry is broken, well, then obviously it has to be broken to something that gives you the analog of R parity, such as like a Z4. Right? And the Z4 is enough to do all what I was talking about. The question is then, what's the lightest supersymmetric particle? Could be a Higgsino, could be a Bino, or possibly even a Singlino. There are reasons to think that, again, with regard to the Higgs, that going to an NMSSM is the way to go to be able to get the Higgs mass large enough. But again, this is an open question at the moment.
Since you have more than just a Z2, you could have like a stable particle of charge 1, and then say a lighter stable particle of charge 2. You could have more than one stable particle.
Yes. So you could. Yeah. Yeah. So there's an issue which I alluded to, I mean, I already discussed in two contexts, which is to the extent to which flavor violation can be found at the LHC. I pointed out a couple of obvious things to think about, the single top and the slepton. I don't know how else you can do this. I don't know how many other things you could do to find that. And that's an interesting question. And it is one that no one studied, okay, before, because everyone thought that Suzy had to be flavor blind, that there was no way around it. Experimentally, there was no way around it. Okay, so now this is saying, hey, well, okay, it's possible. And so this is an interesting thing to look at. There is the, as I said, I've sort of alluded to this a few times, the issue of how big the Higgs mass is in the scenario. What I mean by that is that when you go through this in detail, if you have D-term supersymmetry breaking, if that's the origin, if that's the only origin of it, then you can show that the quartic coupling to the Higgs vanishes. And so that would mean the Higgs would be awfully light. But actually, once you raise the mass of these adjoint scalars to be of order the Gluino mass or so, that's enough that then, because the source of this mass is from F terms, it's large enough that then you regenerate a quartic coupling of a size that is likely fine. But we haven't done a calculation here.
Okay. Get free level mass, I guess, from anywhere?
No. You mean these guys?
Yeah. They're for bids, though, right?
Exactly. No. You can give them masses. It's just that if they're light, then you have approximately just D-term breaking, and then that leads to approximately a quartic coupling being small. And you can show that you get a suppression that basically goes like the chiral adjoint scalar mass squared divided by the D-term. Yeah. There is additional matter. Okay, the one thing that some of you may have in the back of your mind is supersymmetry allowed us to have gauge couplings to run all very nicely up to the high scale. It's suggesting a gut, suggesting something. Okay, right? Now, okay, if it's a gut, we've tried many times before to get supersymmetry to unify, and in every simple model that you do, you find a proton decay problem, or you find how do you separate doublets from triplets, and you find all of the issues that go along with guts. Okay, now, that's just many of us who go into this, we get very excited about guts for a little while, and then once you try to construct a model, you find it's painful. Okay, so. All right.
You're going to relieve your pain by giving up unification constant.
I'm going to relieve my pain by giving up.
It causes a lot of pain to the rest of us.
Not only
for other reasons, but just looking at that one, the only clue we have is that what goes on near the point scale.
Well, all I can say, so I can say two things to this, okay?
Talking about pain is none of it.
Well, this depends on your point of view. But I will say though that there's two aspects of it. One is, well, look, hey, having supersymmetry at all allows us to at least understand what it means to do RGE of couplings. Okay, so we've stabilized the hierarchy, and understood the nature about why we don't have contributions to flavor if the hierarchy takes the form that we talk about. Now, there's a separate question, which is just saying, okay, well, do the couplings blow up, right? There's different levels of badness when it comes to screwing up gauge coupling unification. One is you get a Landau pole in the intermediate scale, and then that doesn't. So what happens here? Well, you can do the addition of the fields that we have, and you find that you shift the, I don't have a plot, I'm sorry, but you shift the SU3 coupling and the SU2 coupling by the same amount.
How many color adjoints are you adding?
Yeah, so there is. So there's one chiral adjoint that you're adding. Color adjoint. Chiral superfield. So it contributes the equivalent of, in typical units, 3 to the beta function. So the beta function is at one loop flat, right? You do the same counting for the electroweak one, and it's 2 from the triplet. But then it's 2 from the Higgses that I have. So they actually shift by the same amount, and they still approximately unify, two lines meeting, okay? Two lines meeting at a scale that is comparable to the scale you had before. The one that changes is the U1. Yeah. the U1 doesn't match up, and it's off by some amount. So it doesn't, so, you know, minimal SU5, no, doesn't work here.
Look, the meaning of the couplings, there are two aspects of it. One is guts.
Yes.
But then there's just the fact that with reason, you know, with minimal assumptions, they meet at a point.
Agreed.
They cannot meet within a gut. And as you know, with the only UV completion of completed theories we have, there are lots of ways of unification, not always gut. Clue from nature is a very important one. I'm sure that if you had, in this scheme, had unification, you would have been jumping up and down.
We would have been happier. Right. I'm not saying that. Yes, so, of course. But the thing I'm saying is that it depends on your point of view now. So it really depends on, do you take the MSSM gauge coupling unification as pillar number one and then work from there? And if you work from there, then you have then you generically have the flavor problem. Or do you switch out of this and say, well, if you solve the flavor problem in a different way, this is how you do it. And guess what? You can actually test it, right, at the LHC. So you will be able to test this and distinguish them. So, well, that's the point of view that I take on this. Other issues that I alluded to, this issue of to Steve's question, the D terms and the versus F terms and how you generate them and their relative size. I agree, that is absolutely something that is interesting to understand. Along with that is this issue of whether you actually can have a continuous R symmetry or not. You might ask why. The why comes in to point number, the last point is the issue of supergravity, and that's a whole other set of things to go into, which I can talk to people afterward about, I think, is the easiest thing. But naively, there are issues with this, with R symmetry breaking from supergravity effects. Okay, so these are some of the open questions, but we've come to a point now where we think that this is far enough along that you can now test the phenomenology and you can start looking at models that might fall into here. I mean, after all, we did 10 years of gauge mediation of trying to do this, so it's worthwhile to pursue this further. So let me summarize. FCNC is the strongest indirect constraint on supersymmetry, in the sense that off-diagonal elements, if they were order one, would force the overall superpartner mass spectrum, the squarks and sleptons, to be tens to hundreds of TeV or higher if they were arbitrary. So they can't be arbitrary. Something has to happen. It could be a flavor blind mechanism. No, I'm not saying it can't be. There is some pain to construct a model to make it work. But what is new is that this lore that it must be flavor blind is wrong. And this is the counterexample. Okay. And
there is a fact, again, from nature, going back, say, 100 years from now, somebody told you there were going to be six quarks.
Yeah.
Would you have assumed, would you have said, the mass, the mixing should be arbitrary? They're not going to be arbitrary. So there's a historical example where we have pretty flavor-blind mixing.
In the quark sector. In the lepton sector, in the lepton sector, the mixings, at least, I mean, if you think about it from the point of view of CKM, right, CKM has a very curious structure to it, but the analogous matrix for leptons appears to be arbitrary.
So you mean neutrino
masses? Yeah, the MNS matrix, sorry.
Another big surprise, it says in general, all guesses based on anything. The first surprise is the lepton flavor. Second surprise is the other. So, I'm not sure what you're learning.
What you're learning,
means is totally in the eye of, usually, so far, in historically, after the fact. You discover something, it's natural.
Yep.
This is one way to avoid a fine-tuning problem.
But there's a set of
fine-tuning problems.
This is as fine-tuned as it can. If you had regarded this as natural.
What do you mean? What do you mean it's fine-tuned as anything else?
You constructed a model.
Yeah.
Put in additional matter.
Right.
On its own.
That's a fine-tuning.
Well, it's very complex.
No.
Well, because in the end, you don't have a place where it comes from without fine-tuning. You just construct it.
But that's
very different than a UV complete model, where you then have to fine-tune certain parameters.
Ah, oh yes, but in everything that I do is a low energy theory without a UV completion.
Well,
okay.
From a low energy point of view, I can just write down all possible higher dimensional operators I need beyond what I've already observed and adjust the parameters.
Right. So by this,
and you put in symmetries that make certain parameters zero.
That's right. But remember, even in the MSSM, you had to put in OR parity to kill off operators that you would have written, right? Well, I don't know if it's natural or not. You put it in only after you realized, right, that you've got dimension four operators that would have killed you with proton decay. Otherwise, you would add these operators in, right? So you had to add that already. I'm not even...
Symmetry is a very natural. And preserving our parity when our symmetry is broken is also, as we know, quite natural and solves a problem. So historically, it happened because of that.
Run through the statements, and then I'll take more questions. I'm happy to keep the discussion going. So, the claim that we're making is that this lore that Susie breaking masses must be flavored brownie is wrong, and indeed, this is the example that we've gone through, and it has immediate consequences. Okay, so, I think one of the interesting observations, even if you don't believe the particular model that we happen to be doing, is that actually much of the Susie-induced flavor violation is a result of our symmetry violation. And that is an interesting fact that, to my knowledge, was not known before. That this model permits order one flavor violation then opens up the avenue of how that's going to change the phenomenology of the LHC. Okay, and it's in this sense of looking at flavor violation, which is an interesting thing. Some of these things are already things in people's minds to search for, but some of it may not be. And so that now it begs the question to go through this. In particular, for example, the Gaginos or Dirac, and the extent to which that is something that you could find or not find, or how that changed the phenomenology is not well known. Okay, that's it. Thank you. Artie.
Something I missed. Could you say a few more words about the U parameter and how you deal with that in this framework?
Yeah. So the mu parameter was something I mentioned here.
Right.
So ordinarily, you would write HU, HD, mu.
Right.
This violates the OR symmetry. So what we did was, he said, we add additional matter with these fields we call R, no particular reason, that transform in the quantum numbers analogous to the Higgs, but with different R charges. Yeah, so then I can write down R symmetric interactions here, HU, RU, and this has the effect of then pairing up the Higgsino with the fermion from the R. Since only the Higgs is coupled to matter, okay, then remember, one of the ways in which electroweak symmetry breaking comes about, in supersymmetry, is, you have the Higgs is coupled to the top quark. The top quark is order one. This drives a Higgs mass squared negative, yeah, and then you generate. Okay, the Higgs is still coupled to top quarks, just like the HF couples to top quarks, just like in the usual way. The R's do not, because they carry different R charges, so they do not get a negative mass squared. You don't break electroweak, like you don't break the R symmetry as a result of electroweak symmetry break. Okay? The scalar components of these things are the same. So that's how it works. But there are more fermions around, additional scalars around in the theory. There are even additional interactions which I haven't written here, but that weren't.
Higgs-like particles too.
Higgs-like in the sense of quantum numbers.
They mix with the Higgs.
They mix with the Higgsino like this, yeah. there are even additional interactions you can write between H-up, the chiral adjoint, and then OR. That's a gauge invariant. In fact, once you write those interactions, the H-up, weak triplet, and R and the analog thing with a singlet, that's actually the only source of CP violation that seems to affect things like electric dipole moments. It turns out that in our case, you can compute an electric dipole moment from these auxiliary interactions that are permitted, that are renormalizable and superpotential, but it's two loops, so it's extremely small. So it turns out to be not a constraint. But I haven't written that here because that's auxiliary to the whole story. Other questions?
You can picture beta function with just symmetric charge fields, right? But that's kind of arbitrary. It's
precisely.
Yeah.
Precisely. Yeah. So it's not that it is. There are degrees to which you can destroy the gauge coupling unification story.
It's just the U1's problem. So it's making the U1 run faster, right?
Particles that only have electrical charge.
Right. Like
only have hyper charge.
Right.
Right. Analogs of the leptons, and of course, if to put them in, you would have to put.
Analogs
of the right-handed leptons. Analogs of the right-handed leptons. Yeah.
Couldn't you also add the analogs of lepto quarks to make it a 24 in SU5? And could you add
good
here? I mean.
Yes. Yes, so you can do that. Then the problem is that then that also contributes to color, and you shift the beta function by not 3 but now 5. That causes the beta function to no longer be asymptotically free, and so it actually runs into a Landau pole at or even a little bit before the ordinary gut scale. Okay, with because it's the analog of that's the issue with that. Other questions? Okay.